The book of Job in chapter 19 can be looked at from the point of view of six sections which were given to you last week and which should be in your notes handed out today. And of the six sections, we will cover the third section, verses 13 through 19 today. And this section is captioned, Job's Lament Over Being Alienated from Family and Society. Why is this alienation important to Job? It may be difficult for us to understand because the kind of life that we live in a Western style democracy is pretty much individualistic. Not to say that each individual is sufficient unto himself, that is never the case, but our whole mindset is conditioned to be that of the individual. You do all things on your own, you have your circle of friends, your support group, but essentially you are an individual, and the most striking thing about you is your individuality. Your presence or your involvement as a member of a community is very much muted, very much toned down. It wasn't so in the 1950s, as I recall when growing up. The sense of community was so much stronger then. And this is unfortunately the trend in most Western style democracies. The rise of the individual and the inevitable alienation of that individual, to some extent alienation from the community and from society. So it would not matter so much to any one of us if we were in some sense cut off from our community. So long as we have our jobs, our careers, so long as we have the opportunity to pursue our hobbies, our personal interests, it wouldn't really matter to us so much to be cut off from our community. But if you do a bit of time travel and go back to the days of Job in the early patriarchal age, while the individual was important, his interests were always subsumed to the interests of the community, and in fact the individual could not function, could not even survive as a human being without being part of a community. Therefore, for them, where the life of the community was central and the life of the individual was subordinated to the life of the community, for anyone to be put into exile, for any one individual to be cut off from his community connection, is a virtual, would have been a virtual death sentence. Therefore, the impact on Job of his alienation from family, from friends, and from society was as good as a death sentence. It was a living death for this poor man. And this is something which we may find difficult to understand, being the kind of individualistic persons that we are. But we must realize the importance to someone of Job's day and age of being cut off from the community. Therefore, his lament over being alienated from family, friends, and society in general is a very heart-rending pouring out of grief. It was a very real sense of loss. Verses 13 through 19. He, that is God, has put my brethren far from me, and mine acquaintance are verily estranged from me. My kinsfolk have failed, and my familiar friends have forgotten me. They that dwell in mine house and my maids count me for a stranger. I am an alien in their sight. You can see in just these three verses how the sense of alienation, isolation from community is progressing. I called my servant and he gave me no answer. I entreated him with my mouth. Verse 17, my breath is strange to my wife, though I entreated her for the children's sake of mine own body. What that means, we will consider later. Verse 18, yea, young children despise me. I arose and they spake against me. All my inward friends abhorred me. They whom I loved are turned against me. As mentioned, in just these verses alone, we can see the progression of the alienation. It is extend like a ripple on a pond, the surface of a pond. This alienation is not only spreading out gradually, it is also intensifying. So it's on two levels, in its scope, its breadth, and in its intensity. And that, as we will see, is part and parcel of the package of testing. What is the brethren referred to in verse 13? The root word in Hebrew is ach, but it has a very wide range of meanings, and we will consider these so that we can understand better which is the meaning applicable to the present context. Ach can be used of blood brothers, that is to say, sons of the same mother. Bear in mind that Job lived at a time when polygamy was the norm, not the exception. Therefore, stepbrothers and stepsisters in the same family was a common occurrence. So ach would have been used of blood brothers, that is to say, sons of the same mother. And we will find in the Old Testament sometimes to emphasize the blood connection, the link to having the same mother is specifically mentioned. The sons of my mother, those would be his actual blood brothers. Whereas the word sons, when used in the Old Testament without qualification, could be either blood brothers or step brothers. It could be cousins. It could even be nephews. For example, in some places in the book of Genesis, Lot, though strictly speaking a nephew of Abraham, is called a brother of Abraham. So the word ach has a wide spectrum of meaning. As mentioned, sons of the same father, stepbrothers, were also called ach. And between stepbrothers, there was inevitably intense rivalry. There was more often the case than not. Classic examples of such intense rivalry, remember Ishmael and Isaac, the sons of Abraham, the intense rivalry that forced Abraham to send away Ishmael, and then a more famous rivalry, the rivalry between Absalom and Amnon, leading to the murder of Amnon. What was the connection there? Absalom and Amnon were brothers, ach, but they were stepbrothers because they had different mothers. Absalom's mother was Maacah of Geshur, whereas Amnon's mother was Ahinoam of Jezreel. And Amnon, of course, was the eldest of David's sons. So that kind of rivalry was common in families where there was more than one wife. But in a wider sense, members of the same tribe or the same clan were also called brothers. And in the widest possible sense, it was extended to all the people of Israel. They were all, both theologically as well as literally, all Israelites were descended from one person, Abraham. So in a very real sense, they were all sons of Abraham. And it is in that sense that the term brothers has been extended into the Christian community because of our common link to Christ as the firstborn of many brethren. We are entitled, and so we should call ourselves brothers and sisters. The common link for us is Christ. For the Hebrews of the Old Testament, the common link was Abraham. So in the widest possible sense, it would extend, to the entire nation of Israel. That being said, for Job to be now estranged from, cut off as it were from his brethren, and to be so because through no fault of his own, is doubly painful to him. It's not just being cut off from the brethren, but for no apparent rhyme or reason. It's a double hurt for Job. So at one end of this spectrum of alienation are his brothers. At the other end of the spectrum, you will find what are called in the KJV, mine acquaintance. What is this mine acquaintance? We go back to the Hebrew, it is yada, and the root word has the meaning of casual friends. So the entire spectrum is now included. On the one hand, you have got his blood brothers, you have got his step brothers, you have got his cousins, you have got his close friends, still his brothers. You have got the community as a whole, even though he may only know them by sight, his acquaintance. They are also his brothers because they are part of the same community. And the entire spectrum is now included in the scope of those who have turned away from Job, thereby isolating him. In verse 14, the sense of alienation and isolation keeps increasing. Job speaks of his kinsfolk that have failed, and my familiar friends have forgotten me. Just a word of reminder, being essentially an epic poem, poetry in other words, the book of Job is full of what in Hebrew are parallelisms, and you will find in this short section from verses 13 to 19. The section, each verse consists of two parallel parts, and very often to understand a given verse or to understand the meaning of a particular half of a verse, it would be helpful to look at the other half, because that would be a parallel to the first half. And that's one of the tricks of the trade, to figure out the proper meaning of verses in Hebrew poetry. And we shall be doing that repeatedly throughout this discussion. So back to verse 14, who are the kinsfolk that Job says have failed him? We go back to the root word in Hebrew, which is karob. And this root word is suggestive of proximity, nearness. But what kind of nearness? There are a multitude of different types, and we will briefly consider these. There is proximity in terms of location, geographical position. Example would be Genesis chapter 19 verse 20, where Lot pleads with the angel who is trying to rescue him against his will. Genesis 19 verse 20, behold now this city, Zoar actually, is near Karov, is near to flee unto, and it is a little one, oh let me escape thither, is it not a little one, and my soul shall live. So here it is proximity in terms of location. Karov could also be proximity in in terms of time, as in Deuteronomy 32 verse 35. To me, says God, belongeth vengeance and recompense. Their foot shall slide in due time, for the day of their calamity is at hand. Karov is getting near, proximity in terms of time. It could also be proximity in terms of relationship, as we will find in Leviticus 21, where the priests are not supposed to touch any dead body in the course of performing the funeral rites, with the exception being if the dead person is a very close relative, then in those specific cases the priest may defile himself, that is to say, handle the dead body. So Leviticus 21, the first three verses, Lord said unto Moses, speak unto the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say unto them, there shall none be defiled for the dead, but for his kin that is near, that is karob, unto him, near proximity in terms of relationship, that is for his mother, father, son, daughter, brother, sister, unmarried sister, for them the priest may be defiled, meaning to say he may touch or handle the dead body. Karob could also be proximity in terms of interest, common interest. It could also be in a theological sense, as in Deuteronomy chapter 30 verse 14. But the word, that is the word of God, is very nigh, karob, unto thee, in thy mouth and in thy heart, that thou mayest do it. So now we have all these examples of usage. Our job is to figure out which is the appropriate meaning in the present context. The general idea is that of nearness, of proximity. So in terms of Job, the proximity could either be physical, geographical, so in that sense it would apply to his neighbors, or it could refer to proximity in terms of relationship, in which case it would apply to his relatives, close relatives in particular. So which is it? To figure out, we take note of the second half of the verse. Again, because of the parallelism of Hebrew poetry, we find the first and the second half echo each other. Not always. There are three different types of parallelism, as you will recall. And in this case, what we are dealing with is synonymous parallelism. So is it neighbors or is it relatives when the word karob is used in verse 14? What does the second half of the verse say? The second half of the verse contains this expression, my familiar friends, my very, very close friends, my intimate friends have forgotten me. So if we use this rule of parallelism, and if the second half refers to very close, very intimate friends, then the people in the first half who are close to Job, though they could be neighbors, that's ruled out by the parallelism of the second half. Therefore, the very close people close to Job in the first half have to be his relatives and not his neighbors. So what he is saying, therefore, is given this understanding, even his very close relatives have turned away from him. And his closest friends, his bosom friends, have deliberately turned away from him. That is to say, turned away in the sense of simply ignoring his very existence and his affliction. This ignoring him is not just a lapse of memory. If we look at the Hebrew word that is translated, it would be shaka, which would refer to forgetting. But in Job's case, the people, the who have forgotten him, their forgetting is not just a lapse of memory, but it is rather a willful act. They have deliberately shunned him, turned away, pretended he doesn't even exist. And they have done this because whether family or close relatives or close friends or neighbors or community, one and all, they have come to see him as a man under divine judgment. So the general feeling was, if this person is under severe divine judgment, then we don't want to be associated with him because there is a danger of the spillover effect. We don't also want to come under the same kind of divine judgment. So we move away. Self-preservation, if you like to think of it in that sense. Therefore, they have shunned him and turned away. It's a deliberate act and not just a forgetting. In verse 15, there are two new groups of people who have hurt Job very deeply by forgetting him. And who are these two? What are these two groups of people? Verse 15. They that dwell in my house, that's the one group. And the second group, my maids, both of them count me, regard me as an alien, a stranger. They simply don't want to know me. And the second half has these words, I am an alien in their sight. Who are these that dwell in Job's house? Are they, we would typically take them to be guests, whether invited guests or passing travelers. And indeed, that was the rule of hospitality in those times. One would typically extend open one's house not only to one's friends from afar who are passing by, but even to strangers who happen to be traveling through the region and who need to break their journey. This was the rule of hospitality. So in verse 15, is Job referring to such people who happen to be dwelling in his house? Well, again, we apply the concept of parallelism. If they are the strangers whom Job totally knows nothing about, who happen to be passing by, and whom Job, as a hospitable person, has invited to stay in his house, if it is that kind of people, it must be matched by the parallelism with the second half. But the second half has Job's maids, in other words, his servants. So to take that interpretation for the first half would put it at odds with the second half. So somehow the first group of people, those who are dwelling at that point in time in Job's house, have to be in a similar relationship to Job as the maids, his actual servants, which appear in the second half. That gives us the clue to who those people could be, that they were people who were under some kind of obligation to Job as a result of his past patronage for them as a leader of the community, or else they were duty-bound to perform some service for Job. So in that sense, they stood in the same relationship to Job as Job's actual servants, his maids, did to him. So it is these two groups of people who are under obligation to Job, who are under the obligation to serve Job, who are the two groups of people referred to in verse 15. Even they, at the servant level, have chosen to ignore Job. Bear in mind that Job has all along been not only the head of a very large and prosperous family, but Job has been a community leader. And for the servants living under his roof to ignore him, not just to to speak against him, but simply to ignore him, not even to give him the courtesy of a reply, is the ultimate insult. It's painful, of course, if your servant answers back or argues with you as the master or the mistress. That's difficult enough to cope with. But if someone whom you employ doesn't even bother to pay any attention to what you say, simply ignores you, that is perhaps the ultimate insult that that person could deliver to you. And the reason that these two groups of people, those who are under some obligation of service to Job and for the time being living under his roof, the fact that they have adopted this stance in relationship to Job is because they also, to their discredit, see him as a man under divine judgment. So if, to them, as since Job is under such severe divine judgment, why should we even pay any attention to him? He is already, is written off. God has written him off. He doesn't merit even any ounce of attention from us. This tragic state of affairs is underscored, is reinforced in verse 15, in verse 16, where Job moans that even his entreaty, his pleas, have failed to elicit a response from his servant. Verse 16 says, I called my servant and he gave me no answer. Not that he answered back or argued with me. It's no answer. It's as if I didn't even exist. I entreated him with my mouth that although I am the master, I pleaded with him, please pay attention to me, please lend me your ear. There was no response. Is this the appropriate attitude for a servant to adopt? The Bible lays out how a servant should conduct his relationship to his master. And there are two passages that are instructive. Remember, this is the ideal conduct for a servant in relationship to the master. Psalm 123 verse 2. I'm reading the only an extract. Behold, the eyes of servants look unto the hand of their masters, and the eyes of a maiden unto the hand of a mistress. In other words, a proper servant would be very attuned, very attentive to the body language of the master or mistress, so much so that even without the master or mistress having to voice an instruction or make a request, they would sense straight away what the master or mistress wants, anticipate it, and get it done even before the master could actually issue the instruction. That would be an ideal servant. And again, Luke 17 verses 7 through 10, the words of Jesus, which of you having a servant, I'm reading an extract, will say unto him, go and sit down to meat. In other words, that it's time for you as a master to eat. And Jesus says, if you are a master and it's time for you to have your dinner, your servant comes in from a hard day's work, would you say, I will wait until you've had a wash and had your meal and you are full, then I will eat? Or would you rather, as a master, say to him, even though he has just come in from the hard day's labor in the field, would you not, as a master, say, make ready wherewith I may sup, and gird thyself and serve me till I have eaten and drunken, and afterward thou shalt eat and drink? That would be the proper relationship between master and servant. Therefore, the ultimate insult that any leader could receive is not a direct verbal insult. The ultimate insult for any leader is to be simply ignored. No response. You make statements, nobody pays any attention. You shout louder, no one seems to hear. And yet, technically, you are the leader. That is the ultimate insult. It is the one state of affairs which leaders simply dread. But this was not an accidental occurrence. If you take a step back and look at it, remember we are dealing with the testing of Job. And according to Satan's desire, the objective was to drive Job to the point where he would give up on God, curse God, and surrender himself to whatever fate God may choose to administer. It was not Satan's wish, and because he could not have succeeded in this, it was not Satan's wish to drive Job to the point of denying the existence of God. That would have been impossible for Satan to do. So Satan, being smart enough not to do or attempt things that are impossible, did something even better. I won't try to get Job to deny the existence of God. I will get him to give up on God. It's basically to say, it makes no difference to me what God says or wants. I'll just live my life the best way I can. And if I have to die and if there's a judgment, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. That is the position that Satan was convinced he could drive Job into, provided he were given by God sufficient latitude to do the utmost. Therefore, since God, for reasons known only to God, since God allowed that extremity of testing to be administered to Job, God had to allow Satan to administer the test to whatever extent and in every area of Job's life and character. You will see in the 19 chapters or 18 and a half chapters that we have covered that the testing that Satan administered to Job was a very measured and a progressive one. It was not just the big guns released in one go on day one itself. It was an incessant barrage of attacks, and attacks at every level of Job's life. And that is the important thing to measure. It's not just the external, it's not just the material loss, the loss of his property, of his servants. It's not just the emotional loss, the loss of his children. It is not just the estrangement from family, from relatives, from friends. It is also, to make it complete, the sense of complete rejection as seen in the way that people have now simply failed even to be aware that there is a person called Job and that he is sitting on the dung heap outside the city suffering affliction, and will somebody please go and say a kind word to him? No, because as far as they are concerned, Job no longer existed. This was necessary for Satan to do the utmost in testing. Job's life, his mind, his heart, his character had to be probed and tested to the uttermost. I dare say that apart from the Lord Jesus, no human being before Job or since has ever been subjected to the kind of testing that Job has. And the fact that this man survived the testing and could rise up triumphant in his faith is not only a remarkable testimony to Job as a person, but it's a remarkable testimony to the faithfulness of God that he would never allow one of his children to fall out of his hands. So now Job, even though he is subject to the ultimate insult to be simply ignored by everyone, he has still not shown any signs of breaking down and denying God. as this testing and the degeneration of Job, physically at least, as it progressed, what impact did it have on the wife of Job? Because so far, this person has been very much in the background. We've seen so much about Job's friends, so much has been heard from them, the three friends that came to visit him. So much has been heard from Job himself, but very little has been heard from the wife. So what is the wife's response to Job in his present condition? That is the context of verse 17, which is a very difficult verse to understand. My breath is strange to my wife, though I entreated, that is, entreated her, for the children's sake of mine own body. If you read various commentaries, I can guarantee that you will end up thoroughly confused by the conflicting views that commentators have given to this verse. For example, they say that the children's sake of mine own body, arguing from purely the words in Hebrew, they argue that this must refer to Job's blood brothers, not to his own children, because his children had already long since been killed. But that interpretation, in my humble opinion, is really at odds with the whole trend of thought in this chapter and in this particular verse. So I find it difficult to swallow this explanation that the children referred to in the latter half of verse 17, the children of my own body, is referring to his blood brothers, that is to say, children of the same mother. And what does it mean to say that his breath was strange to his wife? Many commentators take the view that it refers to the fact that as the disease progressed, his breath became very intolerable. So his wife couldn't even get near to him, even if she would have wanted to do so. That may well be so, but I do not believe that that is really appropriate to the present context. Again, it is the general context, the general sense of the chapter and of the verses before, preceding and succeeding that have to guide us. But we start with the root word, which is rendered in the KJV as strange. In the Hebrew, it is zur. And the primary sense of this word, zur, is that of non-relatedness, not being related to. Not very helpful if I leave it there. So we look at similar usage elsewhere in the Old Testament. For example, I give you two examples. What is the usage of this word strange, zur, in relation to the law? Turn to Leviticus chapter 10, verse 1. And Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took either of them his censer, and put fire therein, and put incense thereon, and offered strange, zur, fire before the Lord, which he commanded them not. So strange, in relation to the law, is that which is not sanctioned, not approved, and certainly not allowed by the law. That's one usage of the word zur. Here's another usage, strange in relation to another person. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 10. The heart knoweth his own bitterness, and a stranger, and this is derived from the same root, zur, a stranger does not intermeddle with his joy. So here the word strange, zur, is in relation to personal relationships. Yes, it is true that with the bodily degeneration of Job, his breath would have smelled bad. But I do not believe that that is the primary focus in this verse. That is true, but it is of secondary importance. The primary emphasis in this verse, in the usage of the word strange in this verse, is that with this overall mental, emotional, psychological, and even physical degeneration in Job, his breath smells somehow different to his wife, as if he were a stranger. That is to say, each one of us has a body signature. Think of it as a kind of an aura, a kind of a body, unique body odor, if you like. So much so that persons who are close to that individual, typically the wife, or to a lesser extent even the children, could tell, even if blindfolded, that it is you and not someone else who have walked into the room. Simple things like the sound made by your feet as you walk, by the unique body signature, the unique body odor that you carry with you, your signature, in other words, those who are closest to you can tell who it is that has come into the room. The one person on earth who was best placed to detect and identify this body signature of Job, that is to say his wife, now turned away from him as if this was a body signature of a stranger. She didn't know it at all. It's as if she didn't even know it. She saw the person there, but his entire body signature was not familiar to her, and therefore she turned away from him. It is in this sense that the word strange is used in the verse. My breath is strange to my wife. And because his wife appeared not to be able to identify his body signature, as it were, she turned away from him, not so much because she saw him as a person under divine judgment. That was true. That was one of the driving factors for the wife to turn away from him. But the focus in this verse is on the extent of the degeneration that has been taking place in Job, so much so that the way he smelled, irrespective of whether the breath in particular was bad or good, just his whole bodily presence, as detectable by the sense of smell, was somehow changed, different. That is the result of the severity of the testing to which he had been subject. So much so that even the wife turned away from it as if this were a stranger. Therefore, she couldn't identify or place it. So understandably, she turned away from him. And when Job saw that she had turned away from him, he appealed to her, and this is the important part to note, he appealed to her, reminding her of the 10 children that they had brought up and with whom they had lost so recently, hoping that by appeal to the memory of their common loss, the loss of their 10 children, he would be able to stir up in his wife some little degree of tender feeling again. It is often said, it may or may not be true, that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. If that is true, the way to a wife's heart, and this is good advice for newly married couples to remember, the way to a wife's heart, the way to get her attention and to get her to do what you want, is to use the children as the leverage. It would be good for our son or daughter if you were to do this. And you can be sure that when the appeal is made in the name of the children, the wife, however unwilling, will jump up and do it for you. So husband, take note of this. So Job felt, and he was in a way right, that if there's nothing else going to move my wife, if I remind her of the children that we brought up together, the joys and the sorrows we shared, raising each of these 10 children, as her memories are stirred up, she will feel kind and tender to me and come back to me. But that also failed. It could not move her. And can you imagine how destructive the impact would have been on Job? Again, this is all part and parcel of the testing. Incidentally, who is this wife? Don't forget that Job lived in an age when polygamy was the norm. And some commentators have claimed that the wife who bore Job the 10 children to replace the 10 that he had lost earlier was a different woman from the first wife. But as you can see from this passage and from the fact that there is up till now no mention of any other wife, and there will indeed be no mention of any second or third wife between chapter 19 and the end of the book. And the fact that this woman is brought in without introduction as my wife, as Job's wife, is very convincing proof that what is referred to in chapter 19 as Job's wife is one and the same person as the wife referred to in chapter 2 verses 9 and onwards. In other words, Job, remarkably for his age, was a one-woman man, a one-wife husband. A very remarkable feature in an age where polygamy was the norm. Verses 18 and 19, we find the pathos of Job highlighted even more painfully to us. Young children despise me. Don't forget that in those days, it was inconceivable for children to show disrespect to their elders. It may not be so today. The behavior of children today in relationship to their elders leaves a lot to be desired. But certainly in the age of Job, it would have been absolutely unthinkable for children to show even the slightest hint of disrespect for their parents, for their elders, for anyone who was older to them. And for Job to say, young children despise me, is really a very terrible experience for anyone, even today, to experience. And even when Job rose up, they reviled him. Young children reviled him. Verse 19, all my inward friends, the reference is to his bosom friends, not just casual acquaintances, his bosom friends who knew him in and out, they abhorred me. They whom I loved are turned against me. Again, the reason for this is because they saw Job wrongly, but they saw him as a man under divine judgment, and they didn't want to be associated with him, lest the wrath of God also spills over onto them. So with that, we can see the reasons for Job's lament over his progressive and by now total alienation from family, from friends, from relatives, and from society as a whole. Next week, God willing, we shall complete this chapter from verses 20 onwards.